Many challenges exist for those in charge of public safety. Police officers everywhere have become increasingly reliant on technology for many parts of their job, and this includes AI, which has become essential in areas like crime prevention. Many policing practices are currently undergoing significant adjustments in the name of public safety. As more sophisticated criminals emerge, using AI for their own means, law enforcement officers are relying on similar technologies to help them counteract and prevent future crimes from being committed. But how much is too much when it comes to a reliance on AI? And what oversight measures are in place to ensure that the technology that is being used isn't making matters worse for society? Join us as we tackle AI and law enforcement right now.
Welcome to Smarter Than AI. Last time, we picked up the topic of AI and politics and talked about how policymakers are making sure that the laws are relevant enough in the wake of new technological changes, especially when it comes to AI. This episode, we're going to be talking about AI and law enforcement and how AI can help keep the society protected at large. But the point is that AI is not totally infallible. It can be controversial and it must be scrutinized, especially when it comes to the matter of life and death.
Okay, Kostub, we're going to jump right into this one. Can you give me some examples of how AI is being used in law enforcement today?
All right, getting right into it. I like it. So the first thing I just want to mention is that we're talking about extremely protected, controversial, and proprietary technology. So actually knowing exactly what law enforcement uses can be extremely difficult to find. And we'll talk about, I think, in question three more around that. But I found a couple examples that I think are super cool. One of them is from the US and one of them is right here from Canada. So the one that I want to talk about first is the company Intel and the FBI. So what they did was they created a technology working together to help find missing kids, which is extremely cool. So just as a numbers person, every year in the US, there's more than 8 million tips on missing kids that come in. Now you can imagine how hard, extremely hard it can be to actually manage this information and create some insights that could be used to help solve these crimes. And with that, the most important concept is of cataloging this data. You need to know where to find it and how to find it to actually make use of it. And that's where the concept of big data sort of comes in. And I know we're sort of keeping it very light in the first introductory series, 10 episodes. So I'm not going to go into too much detail. But the point of big data is that it's, like the word would suggest, a lot of data, a large amount of data coming in at crazy speeds and needs to be analyzed with the same speed as well. So there's this concept of the five V's of big data. It is along the lines of volume, velocity, veracity, and many more different things that people use interchangeably. But how I like to describe big data is that it's just a lot of data that is coming in at crazy speeds and it needs to be analyzed in a speedy manner, if that makes sense. So what they did was they created an ML model, a machine learning model, that would take inputs like IP addresses, phone numbers, texts, and using this big data infrastructure would pop out where a certain missing child could be, the physical location of this missing child. And I thought that was one of the coolest implementations and one of the rare implementations that you can think about especially when it comes to machine learning, because, you know, we all know that, you know, there's facial recognition especially that's being used in a lot of law enforcement, but I thought this was super cool because it was a little different than our regular facial recognition. When you pop somebody's photo into a database, gives you a match sort of idea. What do you think, Chase?
Yeah, that's super cool. I know, like, we here at MNP, this is kind of a subject that hits close to home because for a number of years, we've donated here in Calgary to an organization called Not In My City, and they actually help build awareness around human trafficking in our communities. It's kind of cool.
Wow, that's intense. And it is really sad. I just want to mention a quick sort of story around my home country that's I guess not my home country anymore, but where I'm originally from, India, human trafficking is a huge deal there as well. And there's different kind of sort of trafficking rinks that go along. And it is really sad to see when you pull up to sort of a stoplight and you see kids begging, you know that they aren't begging because they're necessarily poor. They might have been a part of this crazy mule trafficking rink where they get put on the street and then are in this crazy organization. And it's really cool what Intel has done with the working with the FBI to create from what I can imagine, an extremely complex ML model to solve this issue.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So the second one. So the second example is right here from Canada. It's actually my buddy's company. I went to University of Waterloo. He also was one of my friends there. This company's name is GuardX. And it was actually cool because he was also on Dragon's Den. So, nice. You know, it's done really well for what it is right now. So what that company does, it has a machine learning model attached to it where it will try and, actually, let me rephrase. It's a roadside safety equipment that helps to reduce impaired drivers through identifying all different kinds of substance abuse while you're driving. So, you know, traditionally we think about impaired driving, we think about breathalyzers, you blow into a breathalyzer and it'll tell you your blood alcohol level, right? This technology is a little different. It works on specifically on retina identification and contraction. I'm not, again, proprietary technology, I'm not exactly sure how it would work unless I invest into the company, which I'm not doing yet. it through your vision, the AI is able to tell whether you're impaired on a certain substance or not. So it will also tell you what substance that is. So that could be, say, cocaine, methamphetamine, I believe is included in it, alcohol, and many more other substances.
Wow, Kostub, that is cool. But I'm gonna move on to my second question. Have you ever heard of predictive policing? And I'm not talking about Tom Cruise and the Minority Report. I'm talking about, well, from my understanding anyways, how predictive policing uses AI to analyze large sets of data to help decide where to deploy the police or to identify individuals who are more likely to commit or be a victim of a crime. So, for example, the police can use it to map out where and when a number of cars are being broken into in the city, and then they send units there to further prevent it from happening or hopefully catch criminals in the act. But there's a lot of people that argue that predictive policing, they can help predict crimes more accurately and effectively than traditional police methods. But what are the main issues surrounding its use and how can AI bring these issues to light?
All right, so I'll give some examples here of how AI can bring it to light because there's been some research done on it already. My first thought on this is that predictive policing and racialized policing have a very blurry line attached to them. It's very, you know, it's not, I personally don't know where I stand on this topic, but so I'm just gonna give out some of my thoughts and facts and hopefully that makes the listeners, you know, make up their own mind. So we've all heard of, or maybe not, but let's look at an example of a practice that was absolutely horrible called redlining, where certain parts of the community, right? So say you we live in Toronto, certain parts of the community wouldn't be given the right amount of money based on their predominant race, thereby you not having enough infrastructure, good schools, right? So the economy would actually suffer, right? And when that happened, that led to another really bad thing happening called reverse redlining. And now what is this? This is when, say, mortgages, when they were being given out, based on your race, you'd get a certain mortgage rate. So if you were race A, you get a better mortgage rate than, it's a tongue twister. If you're race A, you'd get a better mortgage rate than if you were race B. Now, both these practices are really bad, but what they do is set a precedent for an AI. Now, say you create an AI to predict what sort of mortgage rate should be given to a certain person based on line of credit, this and that, and historical information, right? Now, historically, what you'd get is that a certain race would default more because of their economical conditions being bad. Now, the AI would use this data because the AI doesn't know that it was a bad practice that led to all of this and give out the same sort of reverse redlining results because there's a precedent being set. And we've talked about that in episode one, where we know that AI uses previous data to bring out new insights and sort of predict the future, right? So we can see how this predictive policing in itself can be a problem. Now, I just want to highlight on how AI is being used and has been used in the past to bring out some of these policing issues or predictive policing issues, right? And I'm just going to pull it up on my laptop because I don't want to mess up the great work that some of these Stanford professors and students have done. What they've done is that these two individuals, and Dan Jurafsky and Jennifer Erbart, used AI to analyze the language used by police from body cam footage. They showed us, to using a natural language processing, that the police were more likely to be disrespectful to people of darker skin tones. And that sort of brings up the idea around how predictive policing could be wrong, because there's already implicit bias in the policing practices now. Another Stanford researcher called Sharad Goyal, he wanted to find ways to improve the fairness in written police reports. And if you think of a police report, right, that says there's an Asian female in the parking lot, height 5'3", driving a Toyota, bumped into a car. This information in itself contains a lot of PII information, personal information, that we use when we use AI. Again, the similar concept of NLP, natural language processing, we could mask this information and say, person A, or individual A, or female A, used a height 5'3", or 5', whatever, again, mask that as well, bumped into a car. Now, how this would help, how this natural language processing AI would help, is anonymize this data so that no implicit bias is introduced. Thereby, I think predictive policing in itself, if it were to use all this data that has precedent to be sort of racially not correct, then we could get into a problem.
Yeah, that makes sense, right? Like, racial profiling is it's relying on the data that currently exists, which means AI is going to use that data regardless of whether we want it to or not. So we got to make sure that we're sensitive to how that data is distributed as well.
Yeah, you're totally right. I mean, AI uses past data to predict the future. That's what AI does.
Yep.
Now, if the past data in itself is racially biased, and I'm going to quickly mention facial recognition here very soon. If the AI is using past data that is racially biased, guess what the future is going to be? Racially biased, right?
Yep.
So, okay, let me mention a third CS professor from Stanford. I don't know why I'm mentioning them so much. It's just they've done great work in the AI ethics and AI fairness space. She joined Google to democratize AI and did an interview with Wired magazine. And I found this really interesting because she talks about AI in law enforcement and how facial recognition is used widely in that. What one of her students working with her, and we've mentioned her before on this show, called her name is Timnit Gebru. We mentioned her in the ethics and AI talk. She created a project called Gender Shades that highlighted racial bias in commercial facial recognition algorithms. And I just wanted to mention this Gender Shades project, because after this was released, companies like Amazon, like IBM, like Microsoft were very cautious in releasing this facial recognition technology into our regular space. And we know that facial recognition in the past has been racially biased, where it would traditionally it would recognize Caucasians way easier than people of other skin tones. And that just shows us that how previous data or the input data, if it's not right, the output will also be similar.
That's crazy to think about. how something that's supposed to be impersonal and unfeeling still has those racial biases. It's crazy. Okay, let's speak a little bit more about facial recognition and talk about surveillance states, because I mean, anyone who's a big fan of police dramas like me, specifically The Blacklist, I mean, everyone knows how fast Aram can pull up a suspect using facial recognition. It's crazy. But like, let's look beyond the fiction because this is being widely adopted around the world. I've heard in China, for example, police have started using sunglasses that have a camera on them, and these cameras can upload images to a database containing like previously captured images of people. And so if there's a suspect within this large group, the AI can parse that information, and the officer is then notified from the sunglasses that there's a match. That's just crazy to think about. Like, if you get a parking ticket, you can be easily identified and you can have somebody walk over to you to pay it. That's just crazy. So like, are we heading into this weird Orwellian future? And is this being driven by AI?
All right. I love the Blacklist reference here. Should get a lot of laughs in the viewers. Let's talk about what you brought up, actually, the China surveillance state, mostly issue in the West for now. So what they're doing, okay. So it's called China's experimenting with a social credit system. It was launched by China State Council, or first outlined in 2014, and it's supposed to be released by the end of 2020. So what it does is, by its wide definition, it takes in all the data that it can about you from all kinds of sources, like banks, grocery stores. They're also experimenting with surveillance footage, cameras on the side of the street. And with each interaction and transaction you make, there's a social credit score attached to it that ranks your trustworthiness and like honesty and basically your social aptitude, right? And if you think about it, it's similar to credit systems. But the problem is that this social credit system is not just for organizations and businesses, it's for individuals, right? People will have a social credit score attached to them. And that is insane. I mean, think about you going on a date and somebody pulling you up on the internet, being able to tell how trustworthy you are. You might have committed a felony when you were 16. You might have picked up a chocolate bar and forgot to pay for it when you were 16, but that's still on your record, and that pulls down your social credit system because you're in the system, right?
That's insane.
And I think that's just crazy. That's just insane. I think coming back to the Western world, having a look at that would be quite crazy to see if ever we were to implement it here.
Oh yeah, for sure.
All right, so now back to the Western world. Let's talk about an article I read in Vox about police surveillance technology. And I'm going to quote the Vox article here. Basically, if you want to know how the NYPD might be using tech to police your neighborhood, tough luck. And that is scary. That is troublesome. I'll bring back the Stanford researchers' comments about transparency in facial recognition, especially to reduce bias. How will that happen based on this comment?
Think about it, like constructive criticism from a variety of different sources can only make these things better, right?
Absolutely. And don't get me wrong here, I totally understand the importance of keeping some of these technological aspects proprietary to the police so that the malicious actors, I know you love that word, Jason, malicious actors don't come in and manipulate this information, right? So we know that that's important. But the point of the matter is, going back to the question at hand, a surveillance state, we need to make sure that whatever technologies are being used by the police to police the community are at least openly discussed by the community. There has to be a sort of trustworthiness in the community to be able to comment on that. If we believe that majority of the community is good, which we should as a community, then we should have a say in what's right and what's wrong when we're being the ones being policed. So I think the whole point in this question comes right back to openness and transparency. If there's transparency, if we can tell what technologies are being used, what are the inputs to these technologies? Are you using a record that was stricken away 5 years after because I picked up a chocolate bar and forgot to pay for it? That's not right. So that sort of openness, I think, will help us trust more in our police, right?
Yep.
So are we moving towards a surveillance state? I don't think so. I think the West democracy is too powerful, and for the right reasons, it's too powerful for this to happen. It'll take a majority, like a major societal shift for this to happen.
Well, let's hope so. I mean, if you start looking at the states, for example, and seeing what, I mean, I'm not necessarily a big fan of Edward Snowden, but I can understand the argument that he made, right? In that we are collecting too much data on absolutely everything. And a lot of it is inconsequential.
Absolutely. And it's just, it's very interesting to mention that we are collecting too much data, because I remember that this was a big controversial topic when Alexas and other home assisted devices came, because the main idea around these devices was that they should only collect data if the person allows it and when the person is talking to this home assisted device. But there's been multiple reports of when these devices are collecting data when you're not even talking to them. So there's definitely an argument here to say that we're collecting too much data. You're totally right.
Okay, so you ready for my last question here? And for it, I think we need to talk about RoboCops. And while I appreciate the fine work of Detective Alex Murphy, what I'm actually referring to is this police robot in Dubai. Have you heard of this? This is crazy. They have a robot that helps report crimes, pay fines, and receive information by a touchscreen on its chest.
Honestly, sometimes I just learn more from you than actually from myself. I'll be honest to everyone listening out there, did not know about this. I researched it just for this podcast, and there's not much information, again, proprietary technology, not much information on how exactly all the AIs within this AI are actually interconnected, but I just found it really cool. So just for more information on this RoboCop, first off, Dubai claims that it's ready to patrol the city. So if you're in Dubai and you see a robot, it's a police officer. Be respectful. But the robot is 5'5", comes with an emotion detector. It's able to read people's facial expression and change itself's facial expression, or himself, herself. I'm not quite sure. And yeah, it has a control center, which I think is super important, which sends video feeds right back to the police station, which I think was super cool. It has a map built in so it can navigate the streets well, and it'll shake hands. You can talk in six languages. And the main thing right now it's being used for is like people can report a crime or it pay fines. And I thought that was cool. It was first introduced in GISEC, which is the Gulf Information Security Expo and Conference. And then it was put into the streets for patrol. What I really found was interesting was that they're releasing more versions of this. One will be 3 meters tall that can lift heavy equipment. One that can run at 80 kilometers per hour. And I just thought it was super cool. But now the problems. Now where I see it going wrong. And I'm going to bring back something that we talked about in episode 1, which was EV car crashes. In 2012, this EV car crashed into the boulder while coming off of the freeway and caused deaths. Now, if you look at the entire statistics of how many people crash and sadly enough pass away, this specific incident was just a speck, but it got a lot of media attention. The problem was that it was done by an AI. And the same thing I see with this. If, say, this robot is armed and accidentally shoots an innocent person, that's the end of this AI. I think it needs to be released very cautiously into the streets and how much functionality is given so that none of this occurs.
Oh yeah, exactly. I mean, it's no cyborg, right?
It's no cyborg. The problems that AI can solve, especially when it comes to law enforcement, are endless. It can potentially help save and find missing kids or help with roadside sobriety checks. But I think when I say this, I speak for the both of us. it should be managed effectively, transparently, and openly. This may and will help reduce bias in both gender and race in the technologies that are used by law enforcement currently, and help law enforcement make informed decisions that will help us right now and in the future. And just as important is for us to look at the technologies currently at play and see and comment if the premise of those is correct.
And that's a wrap. Join us next week as we talk about the opportunities and challenges that AI brings to agriculture.
And we would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback or questions for our team or topics that you would like us to cover, please let us know. Drop us a line on Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn, or visit us at mnpdigital.ca.